On this episode of the Fear Me Out podcast, I welcome Catherine Weisenberg, who's actually my sister-in-law. Catherine is an author, a speaker, and a communication facilitator and consultant. For over 30 years, she's been sharing her unique ability to communicate and dialogue with the source, the deceased, and coma patients. To retain a lasting record of these communications, Catherine writes the dialogues longhand as they occur and calls them writings. She's also the co-author of a book called Beyond Ever After, which is a heart-to-heart journey through death and the afterlife. It's the true story of how Catherine's gifts and skills allowed her to co-author a book with her friend Jocelyn, whose husband went through the dying process and was comatose, and Catherine was able to communicate with him through this process. Catherine's committed to supporting people's self-discovery in alignment with the truth that they are already inherently and eternally divine, connecting beings of love. For more information about Catherine's live writing events, spirit salons, and other ways to experience her work, please visit the events section on her book's website, beyondeverafter.com. I'd like to welcome again Catherine onto the show. We're going to be talking about trauma. There are two basic motivating forces, fear and love. When we're afraid, we pull back from life. When we're in love, we open up to all that life has to offer with passion, excitement, and acceptance.
Coming to you from our studio in Santa Barbara, California, this is the Fear Me Out podcast. We're not your typical self-help program. Our show takes a deep dive into those psychological issues that affect us on a daily basis. We hope to shift your perspective and have you experiencing emotions differently. Now, Dr. Dana Saperstein.
Welcome to the Fear Me Out podcast. Today, I have the pleasure of welcoming my sister-in-law back on the show. Catherine Weisenberg has come here, and we did a writing a couple weeks ago about healing trauma with love, and Catherine's going to start off by talking a little bit about herself, just to remind everybody who she is, and then she's going to read the writing, and we're going to talk about it. So, welcome, Catherine. Thanks for coming in.
Well, thanks for having me, Dana. So, about myself, as you know, you and I met in some pretty interesting circumstances, which I think are described in your episode 3 when I was on the podcast last time. So yeah. It's good to be back. And in a nutshell, I have a unique skill set. I'm able to connect with source, God, deceased people, people in comas. And as strange as that sounds, I'm just a normal person. So, well, we'll let your audience be the judge after this. So,
I was going to say, let us reserve judgment.
Really, you would not describe me as normal. Abby,
well,
normal.
Not for a number of reasons, but that's because we're related.
Right. So. Yes. Yeah. So, we did this writing live, and when I say that we did it live, it means that you and I were on Zoom, and I just was writing, and we were receiving the information in real time. And so we'll, I think we are going to just read that for your audience, and then we'll just go from there.
Yeah.
So, but just so the audience knows is that I pick up a pen, and it's not automatic writing. I'm not like do going somewhere. I'm completely present, and this just flows, and it doesn't even need editing. It's all coherent at the end. So let's just get started. So.
Well, before you start, Catherine, I just want to say that after this writing and we got off Zoom, I just started crying. I couldn't stop crying. And the reason I was crying is because it was so beautiful. It was just so sweet.
Yeah.
So it was very, very touching. And I think that obviously the topic of trauma is really important,
right,
especially in my life, because I spend my life helping people resolve their trauma. And this was just such a beautiful description of what it takes to heal trauma and what it's all about.
Yeah. So. And you asked some questions throughout, and I ask you a couple questions like, does that make sense to you? Is that how it is for you with your clients? So, because obviously I'm not a therapist, so I don't know, but I appreciated the beauty and the power of the message, even with the clients I work with this often, you know, who doesn't have trauma, right?
Exactly.
So, okay. So you want to roll?
Please, go ahead.
Okay. God, welcome. The healers all collect their medicine bags. The tools are plentiful indeed. And the other end of the spectrum are those so afflicted by the traumatic experiences. What one calls trauma, as you know, is as unique as the individual, a persistent attachment, and taking on this identity creates the real wound. The same experience to one is a launching pad for strength, for another, a crumbling foundation that never returns. But then there be this trauma that cries out to be healed for those who seek it, and surely those who lend their arts and talents to support in equal measure, yet others who would present themselves misleadingly as magic sources to purge it, that are the exploiters. The traumas are plenty, as life is a complex process, the seeding in the human garden in many shapes and sizes are the people who would rather cry foul than let it go. Persistent, ongoing victimization is not based on the single event, but the reliance to take this on as an identity of victimhood, to abdicate from responsibility, and thus releasing it becomes the very source too terrifying to move into. So this be not a revelation to you, as you see all forms of trauma and how some become so infatuated with the event that they do not want to part with it, and those who do not recognize it was an event, not a sentence for life, nor a cloak that overshadowed or overshaped their own abilities to make choices and move forward. That is to heal, to choose and be willing to recognize that an event may or may not have happened and imprinted him. Yes, but that each being is by design and love able to re-roll this dough and decide anew what form they can choose to make their own life their own. There is in this a process of rising the dough, a kneading, yes, where you often assist in to feel the texture and consistency of one's life and recognize they can be at choice, not only what they sculpt and make of their lives and selves, but that they are not burnt nor formed beyond recognition, that embedded in each human design is the ability to reshape and reform oneself no matter. Mostly this is to realize the magic ingredient is to know that no being is solely a product of what has occurred to them, but many are so enchanted even by the smell of their own burnt offerings that they believe erroneously nothing can be done to reshape or put themselves as anything else than what has been done to them or their experiences in this mixing bowl called one's life. Of course, childhood traumas, when the dough is so raw, barely able in its most basic and essential formation, become more difficult and feel more baked in and inescapable. But there are other traumas along this thing called the living that, yes, are not as forever shaping. And while they involve more work to reform and reshape, it is very possible. So it comes down to the depth and timing and the pressure of the trauma imprint and the intersection of how the individual believes that is the only flavor to taste their life from, little sugar and a forever display case of stale crumbs. Nothing good nor filling nor sweet, just the misshapen leftovers of a trauma dough that defies the reformulation or even the willingness to throw the mixing bowl away and go to the essence of themselves and make from scratch a resilient and tasty life that can nourish and fill themselves. None is easy, but there is an allegiance sometimes with the victimhood that so calls to the being to mix anew, to behold a new bowl, not a recipe that in some cases has been handed down over generations, but to willfully, in one's own self-ownership, become the maker, the baker, and the consumer anew of their own reality, where they connect with their own divine design. That is, you humans, each one, are not the sum total of your experiences, for good or for ill, but that there can be a gifting, a lifting, an opportunity, despite what may have happened or failed to happen, to reshape, reform, and rise in an oven where the thermostat is set by choice. And then you and I talked a little bit more, but I think I will just go on with the writing and then we'll come back and discuss that. Except for you, you did say, with God's help, people can connect with feelings that were repressed into your body, which created those trauma-induced symptoms. I help people release the energy to free themselves so they recognize they are separate from the people who hurt them. That's my recipe. And then Source came in and said, it is also to understand that the individuals themselves is who has their hand on the thermostat of the oven. Some are willing, many are not. And then you responded, I try to help people understand that they have a template inside if they're willing to allow themselves to feel that template so they can heal. And then Source said, divine dough, able to be reformed and reshaped. And by design, the key secret or not so secret ingredient is love. But some who are so aligned with the victimhood would never allow this experience of reality because they have so charred themselves, believing to be loved and lovable is an impossibility. And you said the lion's share of people who find their way to me want to be healed. And then Source said, because they have become aware before they reach you in most cases that they have to go back into the kitchen and see what they are having for their life they are living that leaves them forever hungry. And you asked, so what about people who are having a really hard time remembering years of their childhood? And I just found this part so fascinating. I can't wait till we talk about this. And Source said, the imagination and fantasy creation are very fertile in the young children. Sometimes a failure to remember is because of a traumatic imprinting process. But for others, it can arise from being so in their own fantasy and creation process that they were not storing the mundane and ordinary experiences of their reality. And you said what people have a hard time doing is accepting their trauma, even if they have no memories, but only the symptoms of the trauma. And Source God said, this is not to say you have to run your fingers in and take a full bite of the past that you do not recall, the mixing bowl, or lick the spoon to convince yourself it was real, to let the divine dough and rising capability reshape and reform your life. This approach is, in a sense, to say your life and choices now cannot be real or have power now if you haven't fully analyzed all the ingredients from some unknown past to be able to fill your stomach in the now. It is another, although slightly addictive, form of self-victimization. And then to abdicate taking full ownership to make, bake, and taste your life, to create a nourishing life now. There is no, absolutely no imperative to re-experience anything, because the real healing is not in digesting the past or holding yourself in as a perpetual burnt offering, but being open and available to reformulate, reshape, and put this new dough shape by yourself, your particular taste and desires and work. Oh, put this new dough shaped by yourself, your particular taste and desires and work. And work is capped and underlined, which means it's really a big energy there behind that word work. The doughs of life don't come prepackaged. Add water and stir, and all shall be well. No. Nay, it is about choice and recognizing and being willing to own some very important understanding that individuals 88% of the time or more, much more, depending, create their own experiences and beliefs about their lives. And then you commented, we all need an explanation for everything. You can't have feelings without expanding them. You can't have symptoms without an explanation. And Source said, and yet the human experience is not explainable or understandable. Oh, darn. And then you said, that may be true, but not for most people. If so, we would think we need to be in control of everything. So those who get, and so then the Source part. So those who get to hold the victim dish towel never have to take responsibility and feel everything is uncontrollable anyhow. You commented, that's true. That's what it comes down to. And then Source continued. So the true healing of trauma is to recognize there is no imprint that divine love can't reform. And also, life is baked in an oven, that choice is the thermostat setting knob, and the hand and the choices are controlled by the individual's choices, beliefs, and willingness to see it as them and their choices that help bake what is the texture and taste of their individual experiences and feeling states of their own lives. That divine dough is what each being comes into this incarnation called life with. And while experiences, relationships, events, even traumatic and supportive ones, have an imprinted quality, that the beings themselves are the ones who have the most essential ability to reformulate and reshape, create, and even in many cases, decorate their own reality. That always the essence of love comes in and stays with the being throughout the entirety of their life. But those who are willing to put their fingers in and experiment and throw out the mixing bowl if it becomes too distasteful or sour, and amend and restart from scratch. The magic ingredient consistent throughout is love. Though some may never recognize or be willing to sense or taste or take responsibility and stare forever into the empty display case, saying, why is it all I get is crumbs? The sweetness and love, the rising quality and capacity, the divine dough, if you will, is always there. Roll it out. Some hard kneading may be called for, some realizations, not analysis alone nor memory, can be the only way to transmute the old stained recipe card called, this is how it's always been done, and handed down and down. The mixing bowls of life are available each and every day, and the divine dough that is each one can be able by the individual's choice, decide the maker, baker, and nourisher of a full and filling life is me. Of course, God is not including the horrors that sometimes intersect individuals' life. But for most humans and humanity, there is a way to heal trauma. It is to be able to know you are divine by design, not the sum total of the ingredients of your life, as the recipes in the mixing bowl are not the same when taken out of the oven. There be a magic ingredient that is the base element of all creations, love. And love is the healing alchemy, and it can and does make trauma not the first and only flavor one tastes and the last on their tongues, but a sweetness that can be there no matter what and when it has been imprinted. Understanding and memory are overrated, as in all forms of control. The willingness to love and be loved, to make choices and make adjustments and continue to taste of one's own life and reality. This be where the alchemy of healing, true healing, resides, at the table of life. Divinity is always within and beside each one. Love is the healing made visible. Receive yourself, go with God.
I still think it's amazing.
Especially when it just came out in like a 30-minute handwriting, yeah.
Right, yeah. Right. So, Catherine, I've already said that my response was to be joyfully amazed. How did you respond to the writing it yourself?
For me, since I've done over 3,000 of these now, it turns out, I'm amazed. I'm always amazed at the coherency, but this really, I did a writing called for a presentation about, I did it in July, and it turned out to be Recipes for Vibrant Living. And what amazed me is it also was about choice, and it was about what is this recipe for vibrant living. So when it went in this mixing bowl of life, what was amazing to me is it seemed an addendum almost to that one. But, you know, I always have my favorite lines in writings. Well, and I'm sure I did while we were writing. Say, whoa, I love that one. Oh my gosh. And I loved what was so powerful to me is we always hear, you know, that line, we're not the sum total, da da da, you know, we're whole. But I loved this idea that once we get in this oven called our choice, that I love that because it gave room that you can choose again, and that it's really us as individuals, me in my own life, that have my hand on the thermostat.
Right.
And I just thought that was such a beautiful way to say there's a liberation here, and also this idea that we get caught in our familial patterns and we think, well, you know, my mom did this, or we're always like that, or whatever. And I love that line about the old stained recipe card, because, you know, I mean, I have some of those. I'm willing to admit, shoved in my in an old recipe book that the covers go, I mean, quite literally. And so it just really invited me to think, like, Catherine, where are you maybe holding on to old recipes that give you a bitter taste in your mouth or something? Right, so right. I thought it was so visceral and relatable. And so I love that aspect of it. And that it and all the writings are, you are loved by divine, you are loved in your design, and that we all have this capability that is hard to remember when we're in the throes of life, whether it be trauma or uncertainty or all the stuff, all the crap that comes along with being a human being.
Right. That's for sure. You know, part of what I was thinking about when you were writing was that when I was in my 30s, I can't remember exactly when it was, after I met you, Well, first of all, meeting you changed my life in a fairly dramatic way because you helped me uncover some trauma that I did not have any idea took place. And this was after, you know, 10 years of really intense therapy. And I figured that anything that would come up would have already come up, but that wasn't the case.
Surprise!
Surprise, surprise. And then the idea that such a thing as God could even exist was as stunning to me as the trauma that I remember because, you know, I joke all the time that, you know, if you asked me what my religion was at that time, I would have told you I was an antagonist.
Right. Right? Yeah. I remember.
Because I was very hostile and really bitter about being forced to participate in the religious structure that I was brought up with. It was really horrible to me. And the last thing it was spiritual in any way.
Right.
Because in my family, there was no such thing as gratitude. There was no such thing as being satisfied with anything, no matter what. And, you know, those are, I don't know about the gratitude part, but certainly not being satisfied with anything is very culturally Jewish, right?
Right.
You're always supposed to be striving for more. You're never allowed to be okay with what it is you have. And my parents never expressed any gratitude for anything. I didn't even know that that word existed, let alone had the experience of it. So my experience in growing up was being taught to be anxious all the time. Mm. And that, you know, I joke that we didn't have a thermostat on the wall. We had a meter that only had two settings, really, really anxious and panic. And and every day my mom would wake up and either turn it on to the, you know, major anxiety or to the panic. And those were the only two options available. So they taught me how to be an incredibly obsessional, anxious person all the time. I just remember one day waking up and thinking, this is a really stupid way to live. Like, why am I doing this? All it does is make me miserable to obsess about all the things I have some control over, but not much. And it doesn't change anything other anyways. All it did was make me miserable. And I thought, why am I doing this? This is so stupid. And I realized that it was just purely a habit that I developed as a result of being told that you can't trust anybody ever and that you should never let your guard down and that the world is a very hostile place that somebody's going to hurt you if you let them. And I mean, as far as my dad was concerned, you're either a perpetrator or you're a victim and you got to decide which one you're going to be.
Wow.
And there are no other options other than either hurting other people or being hurt by them.
Had you given me this description of your family, I might not have fallen in love and married your brother. I would have said, I think I need a new mixing bowl. That's right.
Yeah. Well, and I think he was affected by it as much as I was in his own way.
Yeah.
But what I started to realize is that it was a habit that I developed the habit.
The way you thought.
About the way I allowed myself to think.
Yeah.
Because before that, I didn't have any idea that you could actually had control over what you allowed yourself to think. Mm. I just figured that it was automatic, that, you know, thinking is just what you think. And so this was before computers or cell phones or any of that sort of stuff. So I stole a package of stickers from my daughter, and I put stickers everywhere, on my watch, on my dashboard of my car, on the mirror in my bathroom, everywhere, so that every time I looked at a sticker, I would take notice of whether I was obsessing or not.
Wow.
Because I decided I didn't want to do it anymore. And so initially I was batting 1,000% because every time I looked and I took stock, I was obsessing about money, this, that, everything. And every time I found myself obsessing, I changed the subject in my head to a wave that I surfed because I have a treasure trove of thousands of waves that brought me pleasure.
Mm.
And I figured you can't just give up a habit without replacing it with something else. So what I replaced it with was pleasure, a pleasurable experience. And it probably took about a year to fully get over being the king of anxiety because I really, truly learned the lessons well from my mom and my dad. I was really good at it. But as time went by and every time I replaced an obsessional negative thought with a pleasurable thought, my body would relax a little bit because I was thinking about something that was fun. And then eventually, I think that my mind just got used to not being in that constant state of being hyper alert and vigilant all the time. And so now, I mean, obviously everybody gets anxious every once in a while because we have good reason when something terrible is happening or who knows what. But generally speaking, it's not my daily breathing practice to be anxious all the time.
Right.
And I don't really often have to think about pleasurable things to replace the negative. Because my mind gave it up once I found a healthier replacement. And all of this sort of came back to me when we were having this writing because you know, I think that we don't really realize how much of a choice we have
right.
about how we approach our life.
Yeah.
Because once you get victimized enough times, you start to feel like that's what you are.
Right.
And every kid, in my experience, takes responsibility for being victimized, whether it's through neglect or
right.
overt abuse. I've never met a person that didn't blame themselves or somehow either was told that they caused it overtly or that believed that they must have done something to cause it to happen or that they just weren't good enough to be loved or whatever the fantasy might be. There's not a child in the world that doesn't take ownership of what happened to them or what didn't happen for them.
Wow.
So that idea that you are putting forth that you're not what it is that happened to you,
mm-hmm.
I think is so simple but revolutionary
mm-hmm.
at the same time. Don't you think?
Right. Yeah. And also that whatever happened to you, even if you throw that in the mixing bowl and you stir and you stick it in this oven called your life, what you pull out is different. It doesn't even... Except for, and I love that source said that, the magic in always ingredient is love.
Right.
That the secret, not so secret,
yeah.
you know, which to me, if I kind of back off from that, I think, well, that's why a lot of people look for relationship to heal them, right? Because, well, that'll be my secret, you know, and I hear in this writing that it is also about personal responsibility. I have to be willing to get my hands in that bowl. And so there's room for free will. It's like, there's room for a lot of those concepts. And I think it's good for your audience to know when I'm saying I write and I connect to source or God, it's not that religious God. It is that energy of love. It is that universal consciousness. So it's not this, because if it had been that God, yeah, well, you and I would not be sitting here 30 some odd years later, and you would probably still be an antagonist or
exactly.
whatever. So I mean, and it's such a basic thing to feel full in our lives. Like even your sticker idea and what you implemented is to say, am I empty? Am I full? Am I hungry? Am I not hungry? I mean, it is genius. And, you know, as you were telling that story, it's like, I vaguely kind of remember that sticker thing. So yeah.
It was a long time ago.
Yeah.
And now with the advent of cell phones, you have a built-in alarm clock.
Right.
And so what I ask people to do is to set it for every hour.
Mm-hmm.
And if you're trying to change a habit or look at the world differently, or even try to figure out how you're feeling, it's a magical tool, because every time the alarm goes off, you ask yourself, how am I feeling right now? Mm-hmm. And that, to me, when people say, well, I don't really feel like I'm intuitive, as an example.
Uh-huh.
Well, how would you know if you're not constantly exercising that muscle? So the question then is that every time your phone goes off, you check in with yourself to see how you're feeling. Mm-hmm. It's a way of having compassion toward yourself and taking yourself seriously in a way that most people don't.
Yeah.
Which is that I really want to listen to what my insides are trying to tell me. And I'm really trying to learn the difference between my fear, which is pretty much ever present all the time, and my spiritual connection that helps me feel love instead of fear.
Right.
And I just think that there are simple ways that people can exercise their connection by making a choice.
Right.
It's the same thing as, I mean, look, my phone never rings on a professional level for somebody to call me and say, hey, I'm doing really well. I'd like to come and see you. Right. That's only happened very, very, wow. like one time.
Wow.
And that was only because the person wanted to come in and say thank you 10 years after I had seen them.
Right.
To just let me know how well they were doing. And that I said, you don't need to come. I mean, you just told me how well, you know. And the person said, no, I really want to come and just say hi and all of that. But generally speaking,
right.
Well, people come because they're suffering and they're scared and they feel
overwhelmed.
And I will say that most people really, truly believe that the things that have happened to them and what didn't happen for them is very much who they are.
Yeah. As straight up in the writing, it's like that's the identity. And that's why people can't let go of it, because they'd be letting go of themselves because they're in that victim identity.
Well, and especially if you've been traumatized, not just once or twice, but some people are traumatized every day.
Yeah.
Right. If you're living in emotional starvation, that's an everyday feeling of emptiness and sadness and loneliness. And how do you not then just end up as an adult who's starving for love and affection, but there's nobody that believes they deserve it if they've had that long of a period of deprivation.
Yeah, and that always hungry.
And always
hungry. And that idea that not even knowing where to begin, like it says in this writing, take a taste test of your life. What's the flavor in your mouth? What's the flavor of your life? And also, what's the last taste on your tongue? Right. I mean, that's so sensory. Is it sweet? Is it bitter? Is it, you know? And so to me, that I love that metaphor that's used throughout, because it does hook that mind body. You know, it isn't just, I'm just going to change the way I think. It really gets encoded into us. And I mean, I'm not a therapist, so you know more about, you know, how all of that works, but, and that the onus is on us, and calls out that some people don't want to have ownership, that it's easier to just say, you know, I am a burnt piece of toast and I can't compete with my brother or my sister or, you know, I always in the writings find these dramatic kind of words, and it says like some people char themselves.
Right.
That is pretty dramatic way to say that you just keep holding yourself over the fire until you're crisp. Right. You know, you never, you know, and you can't scrape that stuff off with a knife.
Right.
So.
Well, I mean, you know my parents. My mom was a professional victim. She was really, really good at it. I mean, I've yet to meet a person that was better at being a victim than my mom. And my dad was a professional perpetrator.
Yeah.
And he wasn't as bad as some people who I've, you know, been told about. But he was really good at being a perpetrator. I mean, he really believed that the only choices available were either to be a victim or be a perpetrator. And he didn't like the idea of being a victim. So he just spent his life taking advantage of people. And he found the perfect person to get married to who saw herself as being a victim. And, you know, they spent 25 years hating each other and lobbing grenades at each other every day until my dad left her for somebody else that was equally as damaged and messed up. And my mom never got a divorce from my father. She died still blaming him for everything in her life. And
that is such a wonderful way you said that. And it's knowing your mom and being in this family. It's true.
It was so true.
She never divorced him.
She never did. And finally, after, you know, 10 or 15 years of being divorced, I said to her, you are never allowed to mention my father's name in my presence again. Because I'm half him. So if he's as messed up as you're saying that he is, then you're telling me I'm as messed up. And I don't want to hear it anymore because, number one, yeah, he was a terrible guy. But no offense, you weren't any better.
Yeah.
Right? You didn't take any responsibility for yourself. You just allowed yourself to be dragged through life being miserable and unhappy. And you're still as miserable and unhappy as you've always been. And you're going to die a miserable, unhappy person. And I don't want to be a part of that victimization and you sort of looking at me like I'm supposed to save you from the misery in your life. And I remember at her funeral, actually, everybody was sad, except for me. And
it was a very small service.
Well, and I felt a little bit embarrassed that I couldn't find any love or sadness. Mm-hmm. But I remember everybody after the service was going to go out for lunch and to celebrate my mom, and I just couldn't do it. And so I said to my lovely wife, I can't do it. I can't go. And she said, that's okay. And so I walked away, and about 20 yards away from where she was buried, at the top of my lungs, and I don't even know what possessed me, I screamed as loud as I could, I hate you. I felt like I was like 3 years old, you know, and it came out of me with such intensity. It was like,
imagine, you know, your poor sister who was laying next to her in the ground. She was probably like, oh, God, whoa.
I mean, that's what came out of me at the moment of her, you know, being buried, was how much I hated her for what she did to me. So again, I know that conceptualizes me as a victim. And I tried as hard as I could, you know, to heal after that, to not keep seeing myself as a victim of her craziness and my father's weirdness. And I've succeeded fairly well with my dad. I'm not sure if I've succeeded as well with my mom, because for some weird reason, I was able to imprint with my father, and despite the fact that he was insane, in a way that, you know, I used to carry his robe around and wear it so I could smell his presence. Mm-hmm. And that's the way I knew that he was in my life. It was not because of him, but because I carried an article of his clothing around when I was a little kid.
Wow.
But my mom was so vegan that I never connected with her in any sort of tangible way. Mm-hmm. So, again, I know we're getting a little bit off the subject, but all of this is what is represented in how does a person heal their trauma?
Right. Yeah. And straight up, you know, it says that it's love. It's love, and we come in, we're blueprinted. We are created by, for, and with love. And shit happens, and we are take on that, you know, I'm this that happened to me or whatever.
Uh-huh.
But that really is what heals people. And I love how it says that love is, how does it end? Like, love is healing. Love is what love is healing made visible.
Right.
And I just, you know, I think that is so powerful, and that love is the magic ingredient and the healing alchemy. So, I mean, I think it just goes, and I would be remiss if I love this one, because I told you that there be this alchemy of healing. True healing resides at the table of living.
Right.
And that's this idea that it's evolving, it's changing, it's growing, it's moving forward. And I think, I've almost died in a car wreck. I've had all this other, you know, whatever. Is we can stay with the trauma, or we can evolve through it, and that it is possible, but not if I'm just blaming somebody else, or that life wasn't fair, or, you know, I totally get it. And that choice, you know, choice is key. That's throughout this whole writing. It's about being at choice. And I understand that some people who are in deep throes of trauma feel they're helpless and have no choice, which is part of probably the more victimization. I don't know. And what did you think about the imagination and fantasy of some people who have gaps? I found that part of the writing just, wow, I never thought that would be possible.
Well, I'm not sure exactly.
That it said that some people who have memory gaps in their childhood isn't because something traumatic happened to him. It's this idea that they were so in their imagination and creation that they just didn't store the mundane or ordinary experiences. They weren't cataloging the same way. I just thought that was an interesting thing, because some people have gaps in this. They think something must have happened to me that I'm blocking. I'm blocking something.
Right.
But it seemed to suggest that for some children or some people, their creativity, there's so much in there that it's like, why bother paying attention to what my third grade teacher looked like and who sat next to me? And because, you know, there are people who can tell you every scene of their life, and others that are like, I don't remember any. So I was just curious, because that struck me in this writing too.
And, you know, Catherine, I'm not sure what to say about that, because I am the kind of person that I remember dreams I had when I was a little kid. I sort of have a memory of a lot mm-hmm. of stuff that goes back.
Right.
Well, I've had memories of being in vitro.
Right.
And, you know, people don't necessarily believe that that's possible, but I remember so much of being a really little kid throughout my whole life. Mm-hmm. But I've worked with tons of people who have big gaps in their memory.
Right.
And I'm afraid that I have fallen into that sort of idea that, well, if you don't remember, there's got to be a reason why you don't
remember. You're protecting it. You're hiding it from yourself. Uh-huh. And this, that's why, and I think that's common belief in the zeitgeist, you know, then uh-huh. you're suppressing something right. bad must have happened. And it offers that as another alternative. And I just thought that was so interesting. And just a little sidebar. So as you know, I got hit in the head with a tray of food. It detached my retina. My boyfriend is my retinal specialist. I see him more than I see anybody, pretty much. And what was interesting is when that happened, and then I've had subsequent eye surgeries, it doesn't matter. I could tell you my trauma, woe is me. But the point is that what interestingly happened to me is I found that I would go places and I'd say, oh, I've never been here. And Rob would say, we were here, you've been here. And I'd say, no, I haven't been there. And I would actually have no memory of certain places. I mean, and what it was is what I found over time, and I saw a pattern, is anything that I encoded visually in my memory bank, when my retina went down, I wasn't able to access those files anymore because they were visually encoded. And I shared with my retinal specialist, I said, I'm noticing this really weird thing. He's like, well, that really is interesting. And he said, what we now know is the retina is the first processor to the brain. Oh. So it's not just like some little thing that helps you see. And so with that in mind, this idea of how if we're in our fantasy land so much as children and we can create and we're not in like, this is reality, it's more spacious and porous, that we wouldn't necessarily, and then we grow up and we're in this 3D hard-edged sometimes reality, that we wouldn't be able, like my eyeball, like my retina, maybe they can't access the right. file system because that card catalog got stored in a different way, which wasn't just traumatic occurrences. Anyway, that's another thing that stood out about this writing to me is like, and how creatives even now and people who are very creative kind of do live in a different world sometimes.
Well,
right?
That is
and
definitely true.
See things differently and don't have the fixed walls that some of us might have. So anyway.
Catherine, I do tons of hypnosis with people, and my intellectual description of why it helps is that when we're being traumatized, whether it's through neglect or abuse, we go into an altered state of consciousness in order to survive. And that is actually a different chemical electrical state that your brain goes into in order to keep you alive in the face of what feels like you could die. Mm. I think that that's why I didn't remember what happened to me, because I was threatened with death and I thought that they were killing me when they were putting me under anesthesia when I got sexually abused. And so I remember going under anesthesia screaming, I won't tell, I won't tell, because I thought they were killing me. That was erased from my memory for over 30 years. Not even a blip on the screen of anything that could have ever have happened to me. And hypnosis is a deliberate recreation of that electrical chemical state that you go into in order to cope. But because of my experience and with my connection to what you call source and I call God, I have been taught how to help people release the feelings that get buried inside your body that you don't feel when you're being traumatized. Because when you're going through trauma, you're numb mm-hmm. and you don't feel what's happening to you. And it gets encoded in a different electrical chemical state right. than your natural conscious.
Right.
And so it's a sort of a direct link into those feelings. Sometimes they're accompanied by very vivid memories for people, and other times they don't necessarily get, like you say, a visual representation of it, but they certainly get a feeling mm-hmm. of something having happened to them. Mm-hmm. I mean, I worked with a woman once years ago who her family would go to a family camp. And there was a physician and his wife that had the cabin next to theirs. And, you know, she was a super curious 7-year-old, so she'd go visit these people. Well, it turns out that they would drug her and sexually abuse her while she was in their cabin. And then they would leave her by a tree outside while she was recovering from whatever the drugs were that they gave her. So she actually had no conscious memory of what happened because she was drugged to the point of being unconscious while they were abusing her.
Wow.
So what she was able to come to terms with was the feelings in her body, despite the fact that she was anesthetized to the point where she was not consciously aware. And she never had visual feelings of it because, in a sense, she wasn't there. Mm-hmm. But she was able to feel it to the point where she was able to get to a place where she remembered what happened and was able to release it, not through conscious memory, but through feeling memory. That was part of her... part of what came up through using hypnosis.
And so, then unrolling this fantasy and creativity piece, do you think that when you're in fantasy and creativity, high peak things as a child, which might be easier to be, that you are accessing another chemical state, albeit not I'm going to be killed, but equally, and I'm just...
You mean away from normal consciousness?
Right, yeah. Like, yeah, that you could be then in that state and encoding and then not be able to pull up a file, even though it...
Oh, absolutely, because I think that the more sensitive you are by nature, which I believe is a genetic part of who you are, the more capable you are of novel thought and heightened creativity. And that means that you're able to shift your consciousness at will in a way that most people are not.
Right.
And if you're shifting your consciousness, and many, many creative people describe going into some kind of a trance when they're doing their art or their music.
Right, yeah,
or
getting lost in it.
You know, they know what time it is. Like, you know, there was a woman I knew once who could spend 10 hours painting, and her hunger didn't even register until she sort of came out of it and thought, oh, I'm hungry, I'm thirsty, I got to go to the bathroom. But she was so in that flow that it was not part of her conscious connection to her body to be able to really read those signals. So there is a certain number of people, I think, that have a much easier ability to expand their consciousness in a way that they're not even aware of that they're doing.
Yeah.
And I will say that the more abuse a person suffered, the more once they heal, they're able to go to altered states of consciousness at will. Mm-hmm. Because they've trained themselves to survive based on going into that altered state. And when it's no longer necessary to keep the memories and the feelings suppressed, then you have all of this available energy for creativity.
Right. Yeah.
So, again, I know that's a little bit contrary to what the writing is about in a way.
Yeah, I thanks for going down that road with me, because that was really fascinating, because I've never heard anybody say, well, the reason you forgot some gaps in your childhood is because...
You were
in high creativity, or you were in flow. But of course, we want people to, you know, because life starts pretty quickly, no matter as you age from childhood, you know, then you are, there's a way to kind of say, yeah, you can be creative, but only in this way or whatever.
Right.
There's just more... There's just the fluidity of creativity and boundarylessness just gets a little tighter the older we get. So,
well, also a lot of people get misdiagnosed in elementary school as having attention difficulties.
Oh, deficit disorder.
And one of the reasons that I know that there are true people that suffer from ADD and those other, brain wiring issues, but I can't tell you how many people that have been traumatized go to school and they can't concentrate because they're still in an altered state trying to survive what it is that happened the night before. Mm-hmm. And so they're staring out the window all day long because all of their energy is just going into making it through the day. Mm-hmm. And then on top of their trauma, they get labeled as being stupid and incapable. Mm-hmm. And it's really, really sad, because I can't tell you how many people I've worked with that once they heal their trauma, some of their attention difficulties go away without them having to do anything other than the fact that they were using so much energy to cope that they weren't available, that energy wasn't available to pay attention to what was happening around them. So, I mean, that's another reason why people, you know, end up being mislabeled and mistreated, because they're just trying to get through the day.
And so if it, you know, as God's source is saying here, that love is the way to heal trauma.
Uh-huh.
And surely, but really it is the healing force. And maybe in the therapeutic relationship with the client, maybe what it were, I don't know, but maybe one of the healing factors is that is they feel seen and loved and cared for without an agenda.
Uh-huh.
Maybe I'm just asking you, where else might someone who has been traumatized or is in their, maybe they've not been traumatized, but the victimhood card really feels like, yeah, I like this because I get a pass card out uh-huh. of a lot of things, or I'm yeah. just scared, can't make decisions. How then do might people connect with that healing force? I mean, I do my work with people that connects them back inside themselves.
Uh-huh.
Not that they have to remember their trauma, but the writing will offer this to them where they're totally seen, loved, and held in a way that they know is like their soul talking to them. So right. it's a soul level work, what I do with people. But I'm just wondering then how to import this love as a healer to trauma.
Well, I think that
apply it, make it like, okay, this is great and lovely words, but uh-huh.
yeah. Well, you're definitely onto something here, Catherine, because I believe that traditional therapy doesn't work very well because it comes out of a cookbook.
Mm.
And initially, if I did things according to the state of California, my job is to diagnose people, which is to pathologize them, and then come up with a treatment plan, and then exercise that treatment plan. And if it doesn't work, it's not my fault
mm-hmm.
because it's because the client didn't do it properly.
Ah.
So it absolves me of any responsibility.
Uh-huh.
Plus, it's mechanical, and it's designed to make people even feel worse than they do when they walk in the door. Yeah. Because most people feel like there's something wrong with them when they come to see me.
And it reaffirms that.
And it reaffirms that because I'm yeah. agreeing with you. Yeah, you're fucked up and our job is to make you less
right.
messed up.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. My belief is that your symptoms are a form of communication. Hmm. And that, yes, they're debilitating for some people and certainly annoying for the rest of us. Nobody likes having symptoms. But
right. But
if you look at them as being the problem, I think you're being misled.
Right.
And that if you're willing to look at what those symptoms represent in a person, that they're really trying to tell you what it is that is creating their suffering and their loneliness and their feelings of unlovability. So I really do believe my job is to show people what love looks like, maybe for the first time in their life. Mm-hmm. And that starts with me just being willing to listen.
Right.
Because if you think about it, how many people are in your life will just listen to you mm-hmm. and allow you to actually finish a sentence before they jump in and mm-hmm. and give you their opinion? Most of us don't listen at all. And if we do listen, we're trying to figure out a way to put our point ahead of your point mm-hmm. because we're made to feel like we don't matter. So we want to make sure that we're right. And my idea is showing people what really listening looks like and caring looks like is like a template for them to move forward and look for that in their relationships with the people that they come in contact with as they're going through the healing process. Because most people don't know what love looks like.
Yeah.
And I think that we have this idea that when we have kids, as an example, that we don't need to teach them what love looks like, that they should just figure it out, and that love is just something people figure out really
right.
easily. And I think that that's actually incredibly short-sighted, and it doesn't work anyway.
Mm-hmm.
Because I remember, especially when my kids were teenagers, as an example, they were just, you know, incorrigible and a pain in the ass. And, you know, how many times do you have to tell somebody to take out the garbage or empty the dishwasher?
Uh-huh.
Right? 500. And even then, it probably wasn't going to happen. And then I remember one day saying to my kids, you know what? I don't think you guys love me. And you know my kids. They're really lovely people, even yeah. though when they were teenagers, not so much. But they took such offense to the idea that I would tell them that they didn't love me. And I said, well, when you're at your friend's house and their mom drives up with a bag full of, you know, bags of groceries, you get out of the house, you go to their car, you take those groceries and you bring them in the house, right? You would never do that at our house. You wouldn't even think about having extending that kind of kindness to your own mother or father. And, you know, if your friend's mom or dad wants you to help clean up after dinner or whatever, you wouldn't fuss about it. You would just do it. So you're willing to show those people more love than you are your own mother and father. And I take great offense to that. So if I have to ask you to do something more than once, that's what makes you feel like you don't love me. And it worked for about a week at a time. And then I would have to remind them.
Yeah.
But at least it worked for a week at a time.
Uh-huh.
Because, you know, to tell somebody that really loves you that you don't believe it,
right,
they're going to show you that you're incorrect. Mm-hmm. And I think that there's all kinds of ways that we can teach our kids what love looks like instead of just assuming that they should figure it out on their own.
Right.
And they know what it looks like.
Or
they
can
don't.
Say, I love you before I hang up. And
but I'm,
it's
and again,
more than verbiage.
I'm sure they love you. But what about what love looks like? You know, it looks like going out of your way to be kind to the person that you love.
And also loving yourself.
Well,
which
yes.
is.
Well, that's even a whole
nother. And then we have that, then you're an egomaniac. So it's all right. Slippery slope. So I get it. Yeah.
Well, I'm happy if people are just willing to be neutral about themselves.
Mm-hmm.
That's a huge accomplishment as far as I'm concerned. If you can just go out of negative into neutrality.
Wow.
Then you have the capacity to create joy, which will give you some feelings of happiness, and you'll have the resourcefulness.
Then you've got the mixing bowl out on the counter, you're just saying, oh, I'll try a little bit of this, put a little bit of that in.
Well, because I don't think anybody gets a life without pain.
Right.
And there is no such thing as happiness. You can feel happy, but you can't be a feeling. And so we're all set up to be really disappointed in our lives because we're, in quotes, not happy. And that's insane. Nobody's happy. People experience happiness, some people more than others. But it's experiential. It's not something that you can just be and not have to do anything to be that.
Right.
And so, you know, that's...
All, like the writing says, choice is involved in everything.
Everything. Yeah.
Everything.
Absolutely. So we have just a few minutes left. Is there anything more that you think is important to talk about having to do with trauma?
I love this line that trauma is the persistent attachment and taking on this as an identity, and that's what creates the real wound. And that was offered as you and I could grow up in the same family and you'll have a whole different experience than I. And so, again, even back into what I'm going to experience in my life, as saying this is who Catherine is. Catherine is this. She's this ingredient. She's that experience. She's that accident. Whatever, that it only becomes a wound. It only has the ability to be a wound is if I say that is me. I give that superordinate power, and it's not just an experience anymore. And I'm a smart woman, so I knew that consciously this is not like revolutionary, but to really get that that it is really about how we attach either to victimhood, to the wound, to the idea that we're helpless, that we can't change it, or, you know, it's generational, everybody in my family does this or that. And I know without any doubt, because I see it in my practice all the time, that like you help people be listened to, I have the ability to let them connect with their own soul and hear themselves.
Right.
And that is incredibly healing because it is being seen, but being seen by self to self or by soul to soul. And to me, that really is love, you know, that is that loving state. And we know for sure. And this idea that we are dough that can rise, you know, that we can reshape and reform ourselves And before this afternoon, I was eating my lunch, and I had on like, you know, one of those news shows, whatever. And they were actually, the lady had dough on the tray. I'm not kidding, because my life is like this all the time. You know, like I'm going, really, 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 God, you're going to put dough on TV. And there's like, oh, and it's self-rising dough. It was for, and I was just like, yeah, that's exactly what it's saying, is that we are this thing and kneading and rolling ourselves and cutting a different shape. And this was me when my 20s, and this is me in my 30s. And oh, you know, I put too much salt in that one. I'm throwing it out and starting to mix again. But that basic and essential element, that magic ingredient through everything, is love. And it is, and as it says, that it always is walking beside us. It is in us. And to me, that's just the most beautiful thing. And I know that to be true, that we are created by and for and as love. And I'm sad that that's such a scary idea for some people. But I am hopeful and do believe that we all, as it says, have that capacity to connect and rise and reshape ourselves and be reformed. But it takes us to be the baker, the maker, our hand, setting that temperature on our life through our choices. So I just leave it there. It's encouraging. And if you don't like the baking, making, and whatever, dough, you're like, then listen to a podcast on finances or something, right? You know, that's kind of dough you're interested in.
So. Well, Catherine, thank you so much. It's been a pleasure as usual. And I think that there was a lot of important stuff that that you and I had to say here today. And I'm sure that I'll be welcoming you back onto the podcast in the future.
Well, thanks for inviting me.
Absolutely.
We appreciate our listeners and are interested in your comments and suggestions. Feel free to email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. If you are interested in becoming a sponsor for this podcast, please email us at fearmeoutpodcast@gmail.com. Thank you for listening. See you next time.